Blog Talk Radio.
Singing in the Shower, and that song is dedicated to my sweet little granddaughter who is no longer with us. That was one of her favorite songs, and it always makes me happy when I hear it. And with the silly season coming, I need all the happiness I can get. But that being said, I have some wonderful, wonderful, wonderful news, ladies and gentlemen. Even with the holiday rolling around in the middle of the week and people eating turkey and doing crazy Christmas shopping, once again, my listeners, my guests, y'all have just blown me completely out of the water. Ladies and gentlemen, we are very close to 77,000 listeners just on this show. We're at 76,462 listeners. Australia, thank you very much. Y'all are the largest listening base that I have, and I adore you. And thank you for giving us the Teske Brothers. Ladies and gentlemen, if you've listened to me long enough, you know who they are. If you haven't listened to me long enough, go look them up. And if you want to add all the podcasts into these numbers and know that we're heard in over 70 countries and growing every day, we're pretty close to 96,000 listeners there. So thank you. ladies and gentlemen, from the bottom of my heart. It's not my show. It's your show. It's the listener's show. It's the guest show. I just am the facilitator. I am so humbled and appreciative. And in this week of being grateful, this is one of the many things I am grateful for. Tonight, I have one of the most wonderful human beings on earth on this show. He's been on my show a couple of times, and every time he comes on the show, it is such a treat for me because he makes me smarter than I really am. He makes me expand my intellect and demands that I use my intelligence in ways that sometimes I don't always do. And I am so grateful for this author because he is such a warm human being, and he accepts me with my flaws, and he just makes me think. Author David Hoof is with us again tonight, and we are launching his new book called Babes and Bastards. And ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to tell you what, if you haven't read any of David's work, go read it, because you will not put that book down. He is a critically praised and international best-selling fiction author. He's also a writing teacher, and he lives in Washington, D.C., and that's one of the reasons that I just absolutely adore him, because he brings out the best in me. Welcome, David. I am so glad you're back with me.
Yvonne, thank you very much for hosting me this evening, and my hope would be that I show as much attention to you and respect you as much as you do your listeners, because Babes and Bastards is very much about women and women's rights, and how the issue is often clouded because it's made to seem like Jonathan Swift's A Battle of the Sexes, when really the issue comes not one against the other, but an egalitarian world. No one is asking in feminism for us to flip the coin and let the females do to the males what the males now do to the females. It seems to me that if we let ourselves be people first and enjoy one another's company without expectations, unrealistic expectations or intrusions, that we would solve the problem without any arguments or bickering. It's painfully simple, but in Babes and Bastards, to give you a rundown of the satire on men, Fiona Halloran, who is the heroine par excellence of this book, is summoned into our world, the world as we know it, through a creative program by the NSA, the National Security Agency, which has to go private because its writer is downsized by the government and he needs a private outlet. So he sells his program to Andy's brother. Andy Delaney is the man who is being taught how to appreciate women by Fiona. Sells the program to Andy's speculator brother, Connor, who gives it to Andy, who is a fumbling, failing, mid-list male writer who writes macho, Rambo-like fiction. And Fiona enters his life first as a character. Andy's able to discover Fiona is not a fake by writing a vicious little scene where Fiona becomes his character. He directs her to kill his agent in a most unattractive way for a man molester. And then Fiona comes home to be with Andy. At this time, Andy can't deny her reality because the murder appears in the New York Times the same time. So he's stuck with this phenomenon of this woman who just turns him around. And it turns the world around for women. The unfortunate thing for Fiona is that the world continues to be the way it is in terms of some of the men who have hit the press recently, and Fiona wants nothing more than to be herself and to have a social circle around her, a social space that's protected by her wishes and that honors her respect. And when she encounters someone who doesn't agree with that, woe be it unto them, because Fiona is perfectly ready to take that on. And it's It's a wonderful read in terms of female empowerment. My wife, Marcia, has compared her to the Wonder Woman of emerging fiction. So that's it, and that's Fiona, and that's Andy, and it's a rollicking ride. It is, Yvonne, a template for learning how to write a novel. You will find embedded in the story a step-by-step, chapter-by-chapter exposition where Fiona coaches Andy into doing the right thing with respect to his characters, and particularly his female characters, in a way that he previously was unable to understand. So it's a great little trip. I won't give away any more than that, because Fiona, rather than being defined by Andy, defines the story for herself and her readers from then on.
That read, and ladies and gentlemen, if you haven't read the book, no, you can't go get it now. You've got to wait till we get through, because Dave and I are going to talk about women in today's world. And I jotted some notes down, David, after you and I talked. And of course, you and I have been watching this ridiculous pandemic of, I'm going to call it wolf crying. Because it's true, some of it might have happened, but it reminds me of the Salem witch trials, in that one person says something and the mass hysteria breaks out, and then all of a sudden everybody's a witch. Well, now all of a sudden everybody and their brother is a misogynist and hates women and uses women and yada, yada, yada. Well, you know, I've been around the block a time or two, and I've been on this world for a little while, and I grew up in an era where women were women and men were men. It didn't mean that we were not on equal footing. It just meant that's who we were. And I have found that when women stopped respecting themselves first and then stopped respecting men, they lost their power.
I think that's a matter, indeed. In fact, Fiona makes it quite clear that she's defining herself in her space. To the extent that others disagree with that, it's not to say that we don't have problems in here socially. It's that the complexity of the problem is so profound that very often one does, in fact, get amplification of this. It isn't, I guess one has to know someone within a range of true acquaintances, whether it's family or social acquaintances, who has suffered a true sexual assault. And it's not something that an individual wants to come out with right away. It's often a matter that the individual woman psychologically conceals, didn't want to happen, but it was forced upon her by a family member. And in this case, they really will suppress it for decades and decades before they come to terms with it. They may not want any repercussions within the family, but they find that they have to deal with it themselves. In terms of what was or didn't happen, to the extent that the accused individuals have fessed up to it, it's rather not a matter of whether it was done or not done. It was a matter of degree to which it was done. And that is the issue here, not that everyone is guilty or everyone's going to be bad. My hope is that we're talking about a range of people which is, by the nature of their positions, a minority, because no male is going to have the sort of power over women and their career that, for instance, Harvey Weinstein did. That's extraordinary ability to manipulate women because of what they want from him as a producer and what he wants from them back in terms of what's been called the casting couch. That's a fairly well-defined situation. In fact, the irony of Harvey Weinstein is, knowing the backstory for that, I threw in a little pitch where B.D. Wong, who's a Hollywood actor who played a character called Harvey Weinstein in The Father of the Bride, turns up with Chinese food for Fiona and Andy, and Andy introduces himself as Harvey Weinstein. I never in a million years thought that story would break at the same time as the book, honestly.
And getting back to that casting couch, David, that has been going on since Hollywood started.
Right.
And what makes it so sad is in the let's go back to silent films, because you know it had to start then. When it started, women were not thought of as individuals. More time than not, they were just a commodity. And I think that mindset has moved up into even the 21st century. But on the flip side of that, why would a woman want to put herself in a position that she would want a movie part, a speaking part, whatever part so bad that she would allow herself to be manipulated? The long-term unintended consequences are weighed and measured and found awful wanting.
I wouldn't deny that, but the people on the track up, as long as there were going to be women in film who played certain parts, were subject to what the males chose them to do. In fact, in John D. McDonald's, the movie by John D. McDonald, Cape Fear, there was a terrible line, which was written by a man, a screenwriter, who took on a prostitute who'd been battered by a character played by Robert Mitchum. And Gregory Peck says, "Are you going to take this lying down?" Just these appalling lines where the subtext is so injurious, but it's clear that people had no sensitivity to the women going through that rule because they did regard them as commodities. Our conversation today, in my estimation, ought to be better informed by what happened during the late 60s and early 70s, where the woman's power movement altered a lot of the way things should be. It has been since that time an era in which women producers, for example, and directors have emerged in Hollywood and created at least alternative pathways in which women could rise. At the same time, the old people like, and I'll name Jack Warner as one. Jack Warner was an equal opportunity offender. It wasn't just women. He called two great American writers schmucks with typewriters. This was including the writer of, Faulkner. William Faulkner was one, and Scott Fitzgerald was another. And these are no slouches as regards writers, but the contempt that Warner had for them was they were replaceable. If they didn't write what he wanted, he'd get somebody who would write what he wanted at a cheaper rate. And I do this only to frame the conversation that if you look at why women were debased, men too were willing to scramble for crumbs underneath the table. It's, as it were, part of the culture. And what women suffered was merely part of the culture that applied to other people.
Do you think it was because the people like Jack Warner had such fragile egos that they had to tear others down to make themselves look bigger than life?
I think that there's an inclination to do that. It comes back to Lord Acton, where power corrupts absolute, power corrupts absolutely. It's merely a matter of looking at how that applies to certain situations. And certainly an individual like that who becomes rich and powerful, it becomes a matter of whether, in fact, they can gracefully handle that level of influence. And many can't. It's unfortunate, but when their influence gets a bit larger than what they are in life, they forget their role. They forget that there is the ability in a conversation not to win or lose, but to disagree respectfully and go on being friends. And it isn't apparent that a lot of people who are inflated overinflated by their egos because they are insecure, are allowed to do that. Here it's a matter of rights and responsibilities. If a person has a certain right, then they ought to have a corresponding responsibility to which they're accountable. There shouldn't be people who assume or exercise rights or prerogatives who are exempt from the consequences of their own choices.
I fully agree with that. And that, see, ladies and gentlemen, this is why David just, he's amazing. I love talking to him because that just segued into my next thought. And that is, David, would it be a fair statement to say that women in general have contributed to their own misogyny by their castration of men?
I'm not. I think that that is an inclination, and it's certainly a powerful one, given the disparity in the prowess of sexual allure that is taken as a standard for women, but not for men. Women can, by, I would say, extraordinary efforts, and this is the one thing that many men, at least here in Washington, don't appreciate, is that it takes hours of cosmetic augmentation of a woman for her to be as presentable as she would like to be, much to her credit. It is often the case with men that in picking up a woman and going to a restaurant, they are, in my estimation, a bit slovenly. They are less appreciative of this. And certainly this represents a change in my perspective from earlier. But one of the things that I'm trying to do is to grow into a more appreciative human being, a more respectful human being, a person who understands better and allows a woman. In fact, in this case, I would say, to the extent that you want to express yourself as a woman on your show, that's a prerogative. It's certainly, I've never found you to be excessively forceful on this, but I would insist that you have your say. And I'm not sure how many men would be comfortable with that.
Well, that's because you're comfortable in being David. Because you, and to be perfectly honest, David, I do scare some men, always have, but it's because they are not sure of who they are. And I understand that about men. I was kind of raised old school, and that, to put it in simpler terms, when a man is doing a job, my father was in business for himself. So if I went with him to do a job, he was in heat and air, I didn't bother him with unnecessary conversation. I let him do the job. If I wanted to ask a question that pertained to the job, I would ask the question, and if he was at a stopping point, he would answer it. But I didn't prattle on about, why aren't you doing this? Why aren't you doing that? Why aren't you doing... Because my mother always said, Yvonne, when a man is working, leave him alone. Give him that respect.
Oh, I would say so, to the extent that one had a one-earner, one-income family. I was struggling to avoid whatever my prejudices might be in deference to the number of women who have, in fact, accomplished a good deal in this field of study. One of them is a woman, a professional anthropologist by the name of Helen Fisher. In 1982, she published a book with the commercial press, The Sex Contract, The Evolution of Human Behavior, and took a look at the vulnerability of the human species way back when the size of the tribe might be between 15 and 30 people moving with the land, nomadic existence. And the women had the children, and the men went out and speared the meat or protected them from wolves. The women, on the other hand, also found the best place for tubers. They were the most communicative of the two sexes. And they had an integral part in that. It was their biology which confined them to a role of being maternal. That's the way we are. But it also ossified where they were. With respect to what you had said about letting a man do his job, I would say perhaps part of a man's job is to better appreciate the females around him. I look back to where the first laws or the first roots of laws were, and if one goes back to the Code of Hammurabi in previously what is now Iraq, it codified the ability of a husband to throw a quarrelsome wife into the Tigris River. Now, the standard is pretty low, what is quarrelsome. And that's given rise to what continues to be in this day and age, honor murders by families of daughters in Islamic societies or extremist societies, the shooting of a head in the head of a woman, young woman who now has won a Nobel Prize just for wanting to learn. So we have a number of examples. In fact, if one goes from the Code of Hammurabi, which is about property and men's rights, forward to as recently as 1981, Princess Di had to undergo a gynecological exam to make certain that she was a virgin and that she was fertile before she married the man of her choice. This is pretty severely institutionalized, a demand on a woman for what has no counterpart in a man. And in that respect, if we had been farther along in time, I would say, whoa. But this came after the women's revolution in the 1970s. So our institutions are still a bit backward. Our Constitution talks about all men being created equal, but that man didn't include either blacks or women. As with respect to women, certainly blacks got the right to vote, black men, long before women of either color in this country. And I'm quite sensitive to, particularly having two daughters, to be certain that they got the education and enlightenment that they have. These two girls were and are my children, and it was my responsibility to see that the doors of the world were open to them through the best universities they could attend. I felt more strongly about that because my own father, when I got into Harvard and Yale, said that he didn't have the money to send me to either of those schools. And if it were not for something called a Meinig National Scholarship, I wouldn't have been able to go to Cornell. So I had to earn my way through, and it was a tough slog. I'm not saying other people didn't do it or other guys didn't do it. But certainly in terms of the importance that's given to men or women, we're in a world where in Asian countries they now select for which children are born or not born according to sexual determination before the time of pregnancy and abortion. I would suggest that that might be selective murder on a gender side for these people. And this is the sort of thing that we have to witness, not here in our country, certainly, but globally, and take a moral stand on that. I am less concerned for women and their power in this country than I am for what's going on in the world, but what's going on in the world influences our feelings here.
It does.
And Yvonne, I would also point out that the irony is, to the extent that women accomplish, I'm not certain that men fully appreciate or understand that. I'm looking at Marie Curie, who basically discovered radioactivity and how it worked and the equations there too. She remains, to this day, the only individual of either sex who has won two Nobel Prizes in science, one in chemistry and one in physics. And had this happened anyplace else, I would say to a man, they would call him a wunderkind. But here's a woman who very early in the 20th century established that it was done. Now, she wasn't the only one. Hypatia in ancient Greece was stoned to death for presuming to hold forth on matters of mathematics, language, and physics of the time. And this was done because of clearly of threatening the male power structure there. I find myself wanting to appreciate this better because I understand if you look at the way that all of us came into the world, we had mothers. That's certainly a female we should thank, whatever else develops from this. We developed in the womb as females until we were testosterized by hormones. So we spent part of our life as a woman, and we came into a world where if we don't share it with women, we're not going to go anything. This comes out in the book, that there are potential futures for us as mammals, which now have counterparts in nature, where the Y chromosome goes away completely. These are mammals. They're perfectly healthy in their offspring, except instead of having XYs, the male counterpart has XO chromosomes. And that doesn't produce testosterone, which doesn't produce as much social stress. And the origin or the potential origin of this is not in the balance. I look at a lot of films that we've been through, and some of them are terribly offensive to women. I knew a friend as early as 1961 who was so outraged against even dramatization of violence against women that if it came in a theater, Jim would get up and he would walk out. It made him angry that these pictures were being used for commercial exploitation. Remarkable guy, certainly not a product of his time. For men to better appreciate women, they ought to sit down and watch a film called Switch with Ellen Barkin. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but a man is...
Yeah.
Have you seen it?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a wonderful exercise, and she does a terrific job of how poorly a man can negotiate a woman's basic needs as it comes to her anatomy and her dress. It's a wonderful exercise, and it's thought-provocative. It's intended to be entertainment, but there's actually a deeper appreciation that comes from situation. There was a counterpart in terms of offense of males on females to females on males that was done in a 1994 movie, Disclosure, based on Michael Crichton's script, where Demi Moore employs Michael Douglas and wants him to perform sexual favors for her. It's flipping the story on its head. It was horrific for him to consider he would have to do this because he didn't want to. It should be equally horrific for any woman to be put in that situation. Michael Douglas came back to us in Fatal Attraction, where his dalliances got him in a lot deeper problems than just having an extramarital affair.
Oh, yeah.
There was also a film that my wife will no longer watch. She saw it once, and it gives her nightmares. It was a film called Dressed to Kill, and that had Michael Caine and Angie Dickinson in it. And it talked about a patient of a psychiatrist who ended up to be a serial killer and used his ability to know the victim in order to better prey upon them. We look at one would have to look at what the extremes are. I think a woman should be able to have trust in a professional. We have a guy up here in Northern Virginia by the name of Jacobson, who was a fertility doctor, who used his own semen on at least 57 women. And he has what men wanted, a huge family related to him. And the only thing he got in terms of offenses were mail fraud, 5 years in prison. This is a pretty serious violation of not only women, but the confidence that women had in this guy. And in terms of outing them, my sense is they ought to be outed. There is a metaphorical analog to women who don't want to live with men or find them a nuisance. And that's a wonderful little film, science fiction film called Zardoz, Z-A-R-D-O-S, with Sean Connery and Charlotte Rampling, where the idea is that the women have set up this protective shell around them to protect, to guard against the male barbarians who are outside there and banging away at the shell. And inside, it is calm, it is peaceful, but it is also quite boring. And so when Sean Connery somehow stumbles through this barrier, it becomes a source of amusement and intrigue to find a man unlike the eunuchs that are in this that can't be handled that way. All of these things are insights into a problem. There are no solutions. But if you look at the film Tootsie, here's an actor with, and you've probably seen it with Dustin Hoffman. Here's a man who can't get acting as a man, who auditions as a woman. And he has just the kind of stamina and chutzpah and defiance, not because because he's Tootsie, but because that's the way he would react as a man. And that may be, that may get exactly to your point, Yvonne, because here comes a guy on the set who wants to do what the other females are having done to them, who slaps this guy around and says, "How dare you?"
Exactly. He portrays himself as a woman, but stands up for himself as a man.
And this is a beautiful portrayal because he's doing it. If you remember, he used the Southern accent for his audition. And this is a wonderful thing. It flips everything on the head, but there's nobody who goes ahead and continues his behavior that way. They are aghast, and they are afraid that they've been outed.
I love it.
Yeah, it was terrific.
Well, let me ask you this, David. Should there or should there not be a balance in a woman to be empowered? Because I'm very empowered. I'm very successful. I'm very empowered. And as much as I hate to say the word out loud, I am still a lady.
Oh, I don't think that, yeah, there is any shame. I would say, for my, in my best estimation of us, Yvonne, a lady is a woman who behaves herself with exquisite comportment. And I prefer for a lady to be exactly that because it makes me comfortable.
Exactly. I don't have to be in your face. I can have a conversation with the opposite sex in a calm demeanor. And if they want to be jackasses, at the end of the conversation, I can say, "Well, bless your heart," and go on about my business. They never know they've been insulted. But, you know, it's a Southern thing.
that's the way of finesse it. I can understand preferences for women even beyond those that consider it ladylike. This was years ago, Yvonne. I'm thinking now on somewhere on the order of 30 years back. And at the beginning, the most fervent beginning of the women's movement, that I did what I've been trained to do since prep school. A woman was coming, and I opened the door for her because it was regarded traditionally as good form. And the woman waltzed through, looked back, and said, "I can open my own effing door."
See, to me, that's wrong. That is so wrong, David. Because if some, whether you open the door for a woman or a man, it is good manners. And for a woman to turn and say that to you, to me, that tells me that woman has no class, no character, and she ain't no damn lady.
Well, it was a matter of it could as easily have passed without comment, even if she disapproved. It certainly, I don't know how it affected otherwise. Maybe this was in New York, and anything can happen in New York. So I was taken aback, but certainly if I saw her again, I would let her open her door, hoping that she wouldn't slam it in my face.
Well, I have to tell you, any time a gentleman, and yes, I say they are gentlemen, whether it's a child, a young boy, a teenager, a younger man, a middle-aged man, or an older man. Anytime a gentleman opens the door for me and allows me the etiquette and good manners of letting me go first, not only do they get a thank you, I look them in the eye and I smile at them and I tell them how much I appreciate their good manners.
That's quite decent, and that is very often in my mind the intention of doing that. I would do this. I've done it for a handicapped man who would have extreme difficulty in negotiating a door because I have the capacity to do that and he doesn't. It has nothing to do about male or female. It just has to do with appreciating the situation. If a woman comes up to the door with an arm full of presents, it would be no different than if I came up to the door with an arm full of presents and she was able to open the door.
Exactly. It's good manners. And for some woman, and this is why most women I don't like, because most women don't have sense enough to get in out of the rain. They want to be feminist. They want to be empowered. They want all of this, I don't know what. But what they've done, David, is they have lost the power. They have lost their self-respect. They have lost the respect of men. They've lost the respect of other women because they behave like the woman did that you opened the door for. They don't appreciate good manners. They don't appreciate themselves enough to behave appropriately. You hear that word from men. I mean, men say it all the time. But women should behave appropriately because we are the most powerful. You know the old adage, the hand that rocks the cradle rules the world.
Indeed, that's true. I'm considering an appreciation for women. This is certainly not a powerfully feminist statement, but they've said of writing, one should look at situations that exist and write them as they are, not as you would hope they might have been in your perfect world. So if one goes back to the New England frontier in a time before the American Revolution, there were villages enclosed by stockade fences where local Indians were the problem, perhaps predictably, in terms of besieging these villages and sometimes raiding them and sometimes walking off with the women and the children. And in these communities, a woman who did her job and understood what her role would be could still, in a rather phlegmatic sense, say, the men are what they are. We bear them. We bear up under them. We bury them, and then we carry on. So this backbone, this spine of continuity comes through women.
Yes.
And it comes so much to the extent that if there were a biological choice between men and women, the choice could be made against men, as they now are, and for women. There are reptiles, for instance, that do reproduction parthenogenically. They uh-huh. can create others of their kind that are like them as females and have an entire female population. It's a biologically proven strategy. Whether it applies to men or not, humans or not, and see, I've just caught myself on that, because it's an old constitutional thing, and we've got to work that out of literature and expression. In fact, in Babes and Bastards, I've struggled with the appreciation that I'm no longer writing as a 1960s trained mind. I'm in a different kind of world with a different kind of appreciation because of a different chosen sensibility. I'm a better man because I've encountered and had the joy of being in marriage with a phenomenal woman, and she is in many respects more accomplished than I am. her accomplishments don't bother me at all. They are, in fact, Yvonne, hers. She accomplished them. And the expression, being proud of her, it doesn't really apply. I didn't do anything to get her where she is. She should be justifiably proud of herself, and I'm certainly pleased to have her acquaintance and company, but she is in no way dependent upon my efforts or approval to do that, although she'll say to the contrary. She will say, for instance, she was applying for a highly prestigious fellowship, which she subsequently got, and she said, I don't know if my resume is good enough. And I said, the problem is that you're on one side of it where you can't see what the reader is going to do. Let's look at it from the way that you would want in a candidate, what you would find impressive, and to rephrase things which are facts in the way that they're more attractive to the reader and less seemingly self-glorifying. And it was a miraculous transformation for her. And she said, gee, I never would have seen that. I said, most people don't, and that's the problem. One has to get into another person's perceptual range to be as effective as you want to be on the terms you ought to project. Anyway,
that brings us back full circle, David, to the mutual respect in between men and women, and women have, let's take Harvey Weinstein and that out of the equation for a moment. In the big picture of our world, and I'm going to stay within the United States because we know that a lot of the other countries, they don't even have respect for themselves, much less children and women. But let's just say here in the United States, men and women have lost mutual respect for each other because they don't have self-respect. And until we can respect ourselves where we are, we cannot respect another human being regardless of the sex.
There's a good deal to be said about that. I speak not from prejudice, but through the benefit of my wife's experience in a workplace where all of the management, up until the vice presidential and presidential levels, was female. So there was no sense of harassment. There was, however, a profound insecurity among some of the women there of how they might be assessed by another woman.
And women are vicious. I'm going to tell you, they are brutal. They hold grudges until Armageddon, and they get on. They will go out for revenge. They will cut each other's throat. I mean, they're vicious.
And this would be the thing that's strange about this is that during the women's revolution, the 70s, there was a posit that if women were holding more positions of power, that the world would be a better place. And I would say the same as it's for men. It all depends upon the kind of woman.
Exactly. And see, I've been in corporate America since I was 5 years old. Like I said, I worked for my father. So in all of my jobs, I've worked for two women. And I say this from both sides of the fence. Give me a man any day of the week. And the reason for that, I can go in his office. We can have a good old fight. I can walk out the door, be over it in 2 minutes. He's over it in 2 minutes, and we're talking about something else. I go into a female's office. We have a good old fight, and she's going to try to find some way to cut my throat.
I think that that's a matter of survival in an environment that is unfamiliar. One would hope that with greater familiarity, there is greater finesse in this. And I can speak not about women because I don't want to derogate or characterize in any way. can say this about men. There are men with very different management styles. There are old school, be here 24/7, and even if you're doing nothing, create the appearance of doing something. And there are those who are mentors. They get you, they cultivate your friendship, they give you an assignment, let you do it, make them look good, and then they recommend you for a promotion.
Absolutely.
Now, nothing better, nothing stronger than loyalty to help an organization advance.
But I have never had a woman boss that operated that way. I've had many men bosses. In fact, one of the best bosses I had was in a sewing factory. We made yarn. We took cotton and made the thread and then made material. And he was the engineer for the whole plant, and I was his assistant. And he told me a very wise thing. He said, "Yvonne, I might have engineer behind my name, but I'm not the smartest man in the room. I don't know everything, so I surround myself with people that do." And he gave them credit for what they knew, and he advanced them. And he taught them, it's okay to work on your own. Here's your job. Go do it. I'll just catch up with you later. I never had a woman do that.
That's a remarkable thing. I'd like to mention in passing a engineer who was formerly a Jesuit priest before he became an engineer. And Don McPherson is his name. He worked with me on the Chernobyl reactor accident assessment. And Don was one of these guys who, unlike our current Donald, knew everyone, was respected by everyone, and understood that if he got a piece of information in confidence, he would neither betray its source, nor would he take any more than he needed to put the picture together that he was looking for. And it's these kind of relationship, this kind of deep, it's not loyalty, it's trust. And this trust is more powerful than any amount of money in the world. And this guy who, he excelled in being invisibly excellent and didn't need to make a big thing about me, my fault, who else is to blame. It was what's needed, how can we get the job done.
And if we got a problem, let's fix it together.
He was very collegial that way, but unassuming. Someone could rant, and he would smile and let them rant, say, in effect, let's see what I can do. That was not a commitment. That was not saying, yes, we need to do that right away. That was saying, here's what I'll do on my terms. I am, as you said, of your manager, don't know everything. And it's a wonderful defense. But here's someone who became a role model for me. He said to himself, I don't have to appear excellent to be well respected. People
exactly.
will know. And I do love the confidence of being on your show as your guest. I hope that I have acquitted myself as a gentleman, because that's always my hope. And
David, you are absolutely a marvel. Like I said at the beginning of the show, you make me stretch my intellect.
Work
my intelligence. And there's not enough of that in this world today. The ability to have a good conversation. And ladies and gentlemen, no, you cannot go get Babes and Bastards yet. You've got to wait until this show's over with, which it will be in about 5 minutes. But your work not only is entertaining, but it teaches life's lessons along the way.
Oh, thank you, Yvonne. The hope is that everything that's exchanged between you and me is a matter of trust and mutual respect, and that's the only way that I would have anyone react, hope to react. And God knows at this point we have examples par excellence of how not to act, but these are not to be emulated.
No. And I hope that you will come back on my show.
Well, Yvonne, it would be a great pleasure to do that. I, first of all, congratulate you for your listening audience. They are always well served. And you are, as usual, a most gracious host, or if you will permit, hostess.
Either word that's comfortable for you, my friend. Now, quickly, before we run out of time, because these folks are jumping up and down, they want to go get the book, tell them where the book can be found, and tell them where they can find you, because you write some excellent posts on your page.
Yes, I'm on Facebook, and David L. Hoof. I am also can be found at www.littlegods.net. And that's an email address that comes through the Authors Guild in New York. Babes and Bastards is available just about everyone, Barnes & Noble, Amazon.com. Now, my publisher has told me that he is going to crash the ebook market soon because he's gotten a secure copying process. Before this, Yvonne, you wouldn't know. I may be little known, but I'm the most copied, most pirated author.
But you're going to be famous, my friend. You're getting there. I am so proud of you. And I do want you to come back because I know you've got some other books in the works, and we always have wonderful conversations, and I hope people learn from our conversations.
Hope is, Yvonne, that if we writers will create something, that one reader will be profoundly changed by that work. If that happens, that is more than enough success. That's my hope.
Absolutely. So, ladies and gentlemen, you heard it. David will come back. He is marvelous. He's one of my favorite people in the whole wide world. I love having him on this show. And, David, I want to thank you so much, my friend, again, for coming on the show. And don't hang up after the show goes dark, because I want to tell you a few things. But, ladies and gentlemen, you know that I always say these things at the end of the show, but join us next Wednesday night as well when we start a whole new week at 8 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. But if you want to achieve greatness, please stop asking permission, because if you ask permission, nobody's going to give it to you, because they're going to want you down in the abyss with them. So just go out and achieve greatness. And you don't have to be a president or a king or a queen. Achieve greatness within your own life. That's the important thing. You achieve greatness from within. It's like happily ever after. The happily ever after comes from within. And the difference between who you are today and who you want to be tomorrow is what you do. So if you want to be somebody different tomorrow, then I suggest you change your path and do something different, or else you'll still be the same that you are today, tomorrow. Your smile is your logo, ladies and gentlemen. Your smile is your logo. Your personality is your business card, and how you leave others feeling after having had an experience with you, that is always and will be your trademark. People will forget your name. People will forget what you look like. But people will never, ever, ever forget the way that you made them feel. And that is my wish and my desire for this show, that every guest that comes on this show, when they walk away, that they know they are special. They don't just feel special. They know they're special, because when you just feel special, that's fleeting. But when you know you're special, that stays with you. So I want every guest to understand that when they come on this show, that they leave knowing that they are the most special thing in the world to me and to you, the listeners. So, David, once again, my friend, thank you so, so much for coming on the show. I appreciate you so much. And, ladies and gentlemen, yes, dear.
Thank you, Yvonne, very, very, very quickly, your show, your mic.
You are wonderful. It's our show. It's not my show. It's our show. It's my guest and the listeners. I just turn up the mic. So until next Wednesday night, ladies and gentlemen, my guest David L. Hoof and I wish you all a wonderful, wonderful weekend. Join us again Wednesday night at 8 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. And yes, now you may go and buy Babes and Bastards by David L. Hoof. Thank you. All right, my friend, the show is now off the air. And when this thing goes up in archives, I will put it up on my Facebook page and tag you in it. And I will also tomorrow put it up on the 5 podcasts I use, SoundCloud, MixCloud, Spreaker, Podcast, and Podcast Garden. And I will also tag you in those links. I want you to take this and put it everywhere. Pimp yourself. And it also goes up on YouTube, iTunes, FM.com, and TuneIn Radio, and Google Play Now.
Thank you very much, Yvonne. I just had a couple of comments to you about books, not mine, but there is a wonderful little novel, small novel, by a guy by the name of Frederick Buchner, who it's called Godric, G-O-D-R-I-C. And the reason that I love it is it's articulate, it's wonderfully crafted, and very sparse but nicely embroidered about a saint who goes to the wilderness because he cannot, there's something he has done, I'll keep that a secret for if you want to buy, for which he can't forgive himself. And he bets that God could never forgive him for doing it either. But he goes out hoping a lifetime abstinence and an aesthetic existence will allow God to forgive him. It's a tremendously moving story about us, our frailty, and the forgiveness that God can give for sins or mistake for which we fail to recognize God's grace in doing that. And it's a wonderful book about somebody of terrific faith but no confidence.
I will have to read that book because sometimes, David, that is what happens. We don't have the confidence that God tells us he will do what he says he will do if we only ask.
And again, Buchner is a Methodist minister, in fact, so he is putting his faith in the perspective of existence, agony, doubt, and all of the things which are really invigorating and human experiences. That's what makes it wonderful, is that he's able to share the sufferings that other people have for peccadilloes, really, which this man has for a more legitimate concern. But, as I said, it's one of those novels where I, as a reader, was changed. And if that's what Buchner wanted to do, he certainly did it. The other one, and this is for you and for your readers, maybe for another show, there was a professor I had in English at Cornell named Douglas Abercrombie, whose advice to me was, whatever you do, don't ever try to write fiction professionally. Now, on this, I think I look back and I discount that, but I understand that for him, at that point of my expression, he was probably correct. But issuing a global prohibition against ever doing something, ever is a long time.
Yes.
And people can change, they can grow, they can school themselves, they can practice. And this is what he couldn't see. A friend of mine, Rick Sloan, who's also an author, used to take manuscripts, many of them from English professors, who despaired ever being published because their manuscripts, while letter perfect, were tentative, hesitant emulations of some writer they liked. They were not genuine at all. And the one thing, however badly, we may write, I may write, then I'm writing for myself on my own terms. And that's exactly, Yvonne, what you have said. You don't need to say any more than you said at the end of the program. But this idea of listening to somebody without allowing their insecurity to project onto you is essential to our development of our expression, whatever direction we take it.
And it took me a long time, David, to learn that.
Yeah. And it's terribly dispiriting. The author Taylor Caldwell, who wrote The Captains and the Kings, had not only her manuscript was rejected, she would pass them over the transom in New York and with stamps for return postage, never to have a reply, and to learn that her stamps had been stolen.
Oh, my word.
This is appalling. This is one of those real-life stories about the trade which you wish weren't true, but there are enough agents out there who knew her and eventually represented her to know the story, and you know what? She never complained.
She just kept on doing her thing.
Yep.
And I love it because we can sometimes become our own worst enemy.
Talk about tenacity. It's the people where if you make the mark, somebody goes up and raises the bar after you've shown, and you have to go back to the runway with your pole and line up and run down and plant the pole in the pit and go over another height. And people do it.
And my philosophy is that that does not kill us will only make us stronger. And
yep.
I'm still around. I'm still here. So I must be pretty darn strong.
Well, I think you are, and it's a great gift to other people. You may be surprised at how many of your readers are listening for some kind of encouragement or emulation or just a piece of wisdom, an insight about how to do something. If it's this catalyst, this small area that repeatedly allows you to assemble words and create them, then if that catalyst is within anything you broadcast, your guest broadcast, or even I mention, then you've done a service for on the order of 100,000 plus people. The thing that I would contrast that with, if you want to go to bed happy, Yvonne, it's this. Kurt Vonnegut wrote this wonderful little short story about a Nazi doctor who committed atrocities and murders and horrible experiments and was able to escape to South America. There he vowed, as a doctor, to save as many lives as he'd taken as a Nazi doctor. And Vonnegut's final sentence was, he had only 598,372 lives to save to break even.
Well, I guess we got another 200,000 people just to break even to make a difference for 10.
Yeah. It's a wonderful thing, but those people who forget their moral center, reckoning that they're somehow they can balance the scale rationally on their terms, are deceiving themselves at the point they betray their moral character.
Exactly. Very well said. Very well said. And when we forget where we come from, we can never get to where we're going.
And I think we've had those lessons. It's a matter of just learning them.
Yep.
I'm very proud of this. I'm very pleased with this opportunity. In terms of significance, you may be over-attributing. As a scientist, I look at us in a big, big universe. And I find it somewhat comical when a person thinks that they are bigger than themselves or the world is always going to remember them, because it probably won't.
Well, my mother always said, you know, the higher you climb and the more proud that you get, the harder you fall.
It's that a lot of people don't understand that the word tyrant came from Zoroastrian origin. A tyrant means a tower, and a tower is a inflating place where people look down and lose touch with the things beneath.
And I never want, because this show would not be anything without you and the other guests and the listeners. It would just be another show. Y'all are what makes this show successful.
Well, I thank you. I thank you for saying that, Yvonne. You're quite a gracious hostess, and I'm impressed by what you've done. As you should be, as I said with my wife, I said to her, it's your credentials, and she said, yes, but they would never have been rendered this way without your help. And I had said, well, maybe.
And I rest my case, Your Honor. And with that, I will once again say thank you, and I want to bring you back in May. You should have something out by then, or pretty close to being out by then. And we will continue our diverse and intellectual conversations and maybe teach people a few things.
Yvonne, I do thank you for your comments and your views. I found them invigorating. Thanks.
Different. Very different. So stay up with me and let me stay up with you so I can see where you're going, and tell me how Babes and Bastards is doing out there, because I'm going to get it and read it. It's intrigued me now.
Well, Yvonne, with the confidence of email, not Facebook, Facebook is a bit too open, an email. If you feel comfortable sending me an address, even a P.O. box address.
Oh, honey, I'll send you my address. I'm all over the world. People know me all over the world. So, you know, I'm pretty sure NASA or the FBI has got my address. I don't care.
I'm sure they have mine, but and nonetheless, well, you've got to, wonderful Southern Senator and gentleman J. William Fulbright. When he was vilified by Spiro Agnew, they said, how do you react to this, Senator Fulbright? What's your take on this? What are you going to say? And he smiled into the microphone, knowing smile, and said, well, I think in this case, you've got to consider the source.
Exactly. And yes, I will send you my address, my dear. I will be happy to.
And I could send it along to you. James Carlson, who's also on Facebook, is quite familiar with you and has quite a lot of contacts as well.
Mm-hmm.
And to the extent that these are good people out there and they wish you no well, I'm all for awareness that we can get. God bless you. Have a good night, and we will be in touch.
And thank you again, my dear, for coming on the show.
You're so welcome.
Talk to you later.
Yes. Take care now.
Good night. Good night, my dear.